From Minnesota to New Jersey, South Carolina to Utah, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Russia has canceled the Black Sea Grain Initiative that will have an impact on world grain supplies and ultimately on food costs in the United States. George Beebe from the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft is here with details. Joe Biden is running a low-energy re-election campaign, and Republicans are gearing up for their first candidate debate. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on the 2024 race for the White House. Earlier in his career, Joe Biden talked a lot about budget deficits. Now he doesn't seem quite as concerned. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And when the left can't win by the rules, they change the rules. The Supreme Court of the United States is their latest target. I'll have this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Russia has canceled the Black Sea Grain Initiative, which allowed Ukraine to continue exporting grain by sea despite the ongoing war between the two nations. It will have an impact on grocery prices here in the United States. For details, we turn to George Beebe. He is Director of Grand Strategy at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. George, welcome to American Radio Journal. George, the Black Sea Grain Deal, could you give us, first of all, some background on what the deal is and how it came about?
When this war started back in February of 2022, the Russian Navy blockaded Ukraine's southern coast as part of the war effort. And this had a profound effect on Ukraine's ability to export grains. And Ukraine is one of the world's largest exporters of grain. So this had a fairly quick effect on world food prices. And I think many Americans might recall having to pay a lot more for loaves of bread at the grocery store back in mid-2022. I'm not sure a lot of people connected the dots as to what was causing this, but this had a big impact on world food prices and on food availability in certain parts of the world. So the United Nations, with Turkish mediation help, tried to find some sort of deal between Ukraine and Russia that would allow Ukrainian grain exports to resume. And in July of 2022, they reached this deal. And it allowed Ukrainian grain exports to go through mined waters with escorts. And it also provided for inspections of those cargo ships to make sure, from the Russian perspective, that they weren't also carrying weapons to Ukraine. And this worked pretty well. This had an effect on world food prices, and everybody was pleased with this, except the Russians grew increasingly unhappy about how this was being implemented, because as part of the deal, they were assured, A, that a lot of the Ukrainian grain exports would go to poorer parts of the world in what we call the global south that really have food shortages. And that didn't happen. Most of the Ukrainian exports were actually going to Europe and to China and to Turkey, not to the global south. And this caused the Russians to say, hey, wait a minute. You know, we thought we were doing this as a humanitarian gesture to parts of the world that were really in need, not as some sort of sop to wealthy European consumers. And then the other part of this was that the Russians were assured as part of this deal that they would get help with their own grain exports. And Russia's even bigger producer and exporter of grain than Ukraine is. That hasn't happened either. So for many months now, the Russians have been warning that unless their concerns about their own grain exports were addressed, that they were not going to stay in the deal. And they warned and they warned, and then finally they said, okay, enough, we're out of the deal. We've suspended it. So the question now is, can a deal be reached with the Russians to allow Ukrainian exports to resume again?
Is there not another route for those exports to take, George, say, perhaps overland through Europe?
Well, not really. It's certainly possible to ship some of this overland through Europe, but most of that gets done by railway. And the railway gauges between Europe and Ukraine are not the same. So you've got to change cars and move the grains from one train to another. Very, very awkward. That limits how much can really be done in that way. The other part of this is that European farmers, you know, particularly in countries close to Ukraine, are essentially complaining quite loudly about the competition from Ukrainian exports. That hurts their own ability to make profits. And so the EU has actually exempted a lot of Eastern European EU members from having to import anything from Ukraine. So they've essentially banned Ukrainian food imports in several EU countries as a result of this. So that imposes real limitations on what can be done overland.
Looking at the situation then, you referenced the fact that the last time we had the problem of Ukraine not being able to use water routes to export their grain, it spiked bread prices in the United States. So are we looking here at perhaps another grain shortage, a shortage that is going to create a spike in prices? And if that happens, what impact is that going to have on our own inflation rate, which, you know, George, we've actually seen some progress in getting inflation down in the last couple of months. Could this knock that off of the railway as well?
Well, I think it could, yes. Already futures markets are skyrocketing on these grain prices. So that suggests that we're going to see that translated into higher prices at the cash registers in the not-too-distant future. Unless some sort of new deal can be struck with the Russians that satisfies some of their concerns. So right now, I think unless the diplomats are able to find a way forward, and I don't rule that out, I think the Russians probably are willing to make a deal, but it's going to have to be on somewhat different terms than what the original grain deal provided for. But unless that happens, then yeah, I think we're headed toward some additional inflationary pressures.
And could this also have an impact? And you did reference the fact that much of this grain is going to countries other than the global south, where we have food shortages and starvation. But taking Ukrainian grain out of the world supply, is that going to make even worse the problem of hunger in those countries?
Well, I think that it will, yes. I think there are compelling reasons to try to find a way forward here. Humanitarian concerns about the global south, certainly a big part of this. Inflationary pressures in wealthier parts of the world, including the United States, is another part of this.
We have been talking with George Beebe, who is Director of Grand Strategy at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And George, tell us a little bit about the Quincy Institute. Also, where can folks go on the web? You've written extensively about this and many related topics. Where can folks find that information?
The Quincy Institute website is at www.quincyinst.org. And we're focused on promoting, as our name implies, a more responsible, more restrained role for the United States in the world, emphasizing diplomacy and less reliance on military force and coercion in advancing U.S. foreign policy interests.
George Beebe of the Quincy Institute. George, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Of course, the big story this past week, the potential indictment of Donald Trump yet again. And we also had Ron DeSantis out there with a major speech on preparedness in the military. So much action in the presidential race. But where's Joe Biden? We're going to talk about that with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Where is Joe Biden, Scott? In 2020, he campaigned from his basement, which, as you've pointed out, is not really a campaign at all. We haven't seen any rallies or too much activity from President Biden. Is he planning to take a low-key approach again this year?
President Biden was certainly doing a little bit of travel earlier this month when he went over to Europe and took some naps and skipped some dinners and appeared confused just about everywhere that he did appear. And I think that it is very much a foreshadowing of the president's energy when it comes to the 2024 election. Folks know that he's lost a step. We know that he's effectively not going to be running a campaign in the traditional way and doing direct voter contact and shaking hands and you know, hopefully not nibbling on babies like he was in Europe. But I think that Biden, very much like the 2020 election, is going to try to stay out of his own way and prevent any of these unforced errors from becoming big viral moments and allowing the American people to continue to question his mental capacity and physical capacity to be able to handle another 4 years in the West Wing. Obviously, we've seen the Republicans barnstorming throughout early states like Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and even elsewhere, right? Throughout America, some people are starting to take a look at the Super Tuesday states. But we're about 6 months out. And what that means is that there's going to be a robust Republican primary process. We know President Trump is leading in a big way in the national polling, but it comes down to these early states and the way that folks can try to get some momentum there. We've seen a lot of excitement around some of these candidates like Vivek Ramaswamy. We know that DeSantis has a little bit of a base. We know that Tim Scott has $40 million in a super PAC that's going to be spent. And we know exactly what the staying power is from President Trump. We know that Mike Pence and others are trying to break through in some of the early states. There's a contest that's unraveling before us, but what we're not really seeing is just any Biden surrogates campaigning or President Biden or Kamala Harris actually visiting the early states.
There seems to be a substantial number of folks, growing number of folks, who are seeing the president as not really being physically or mentally up to the challenge of another 4 years. Does this open the door at all for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., or is the deck so stacked against him that he's not really going to become viable?
Well, the deck is certainly stacked against him when you talk about taking on an incumbent president. That being said, RFK, there are some sources in New Hampshire that are convinced that he has a chance to defeat Biden in New Hampshire. And if the sitting president loses one of the early states, you never know what other dominoes are going to fall. So I think that the Biden campaign is certainly trying to figure out how to deal with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And in addition to that, you've also got Kennedy out there talking about some big, big things, including making Bitcoin the reserve currency of the United States for our full faith and credit. That gets the excitement of some of these young people that are investing in digital assets. And when you're trying to build new coalitions, maybe against the old blue blood money that comes from the Northeast that Biden has traditionally attracted, Kennedy's sort of a breath of fresh air for some of these folks. So we'll see exactly how all that unfolds in the coming months. But if I'm the Biden campaign, I certainly am trying to shield the president, but also project strength. And I don't think that they can project the strength, because every time he does come out, he appears to be lost, feeble, and really just confused. And he's showing direct signs of dementia. I think that it's quite unfortunate. Some of us kind of wonder who exactly is making the decisions in the West Wing.
On the Republican side here, Scott, we have a debate coming up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in just a couple of weeks. Do you see that as a pivotal opportunity for any candidate not named Trump?
Well, we'll see if President Trump ultimately decides to participate. I think right now his team is saying, well, we're probably not going to do that. But there are candidates like Doug Burgum, right? He encouraged everybody over social media to donate just $1, and then he would send you a $20 gift card from, I think, Visa. And so that's how he hit the donor threshold to be eligible to participate in the debates. You know, you're talking about a wealthy self-funder who's trying to build a grassroots momentum like that, and ultimately he did qualify already. And so there's going to be other candidates that are going to try to think about new creative ways to also have access to our debate process. And I think that the debate's largely going to be overshadowed by whatever President Trump is doing if he doesn't participate. Let's just imagine that instead of participating in that debate in Wisconsin, that he goes and does a big rally in Iowa or New Hampshire or does a town hall in South Carolina. What kind of coverage is the media going to give that? And it reminds me, honestly, of the 2016 presidential nominating contest, because there were a lot of Republican candidates that banked on this idea that they were going to get free earned media. And what they ran into was the Trump buzzsaw and the media's obsession with covering every single Trump move. We know that this week Governor DeSantis had a big interview with CNN and Jake Tapper. Well, they cut away from that interview because of the information and news breaking related to Donald Trump's newest indictment. And so I do think that there's this clear media obsession, and they know that it leads to ratings with covering President Trump. How do other candidates break through is a big, big question as we approach the beginning of 2024.
And we will keep an eye on all of these developments every week with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Our organization is united in this idea of economic freedom and liberty and opportunity. Anybody can join Club for Growth as a member for free. All you've got to do is visit www.clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again.
Thank you.
Unlike earlier in his administration, President Joe Biden seems to be unconcerned about the rapidly growing federal budget deficit. For details, we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
At times last summer, it seemed like the only thing President Joe Biden wanted to talk about was the federal deficit and how he had supposedly reduced it by over $1 trillion.
We're on track to cut the federal deficit by another $1.5 trillion by the end of this fiscal year, the biggest decline in a single year ever in American history, the biggest decline on top of us having a $350 billion drop in the deficit last year, my first year as president.
I mean, really, this is all he talked about. For weeks, every time Biden made a public appearance, there would be something about the deficit reduction.
All the talk about the deficit from my Republican friends, I love it. I've reduced it $350 billion in my first year in office. And we're on track to reduce it by the end of September by another $1.5 trillion, the largest drop ever.
But you know what I've noticed? I've noticed that Biden doesn't talk about the deficit anymore. And I wonder why that is. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at the status of the federal budget deficit, which is growing again. Yes, despite the fact that the White House spent several months last year trying to convince you otherwise. None of this was Biden shooting from the hip. Those clips I just played for you, those were all scripted remarks at press conferences. The White House also pushed out fact sheets to reporters, and they made shareable graphics on social media, all of which was intended to emphasize the apparently falling budget deficit. And at the center of all of it was this claim that the Biden administration had somehow cut the federal deficit by over $1 trillion in 1 year. That's a huge number. Of course, as Reason, where I work, and other publications pointed out at the time, the falling budget deficit was actually not the result of anything the president had done. Instead, it was just purely because there had been an unprecedented amount of federal spending in 2020 and 2021 due to that, you know, that big pandemic we had back then and all the emergency spending that happened in those years. So if you start measuring from those 2 years, if you start with the $3.1 trillion deficit that we had in 2020 and you look at the $2.7 trillion deficit that we had in 2021, the biggest deficits in raw numbers that America has ever run, well, if you start with those totals, then of course whatever comes next is going to look a lot smaller. So the deficit fell from $3.1 trillion in 2020 to $2.7 trillion in 2021 and then down to about $1.3 trillion last year. That was just because the pandemic had passed and federal spending returned to normal levels, so the annual budget deficit did too. In fact, $1.3 trillion is one of the higher deficits in recent history. That had nothing to do with Biden's policies. In fact, the deficit would have fallen further last year if not for things that Biden supported, like the infrastructure bill and last year's federal budget bill, both of which added to the deficit, even though the number was getting smaller. Now, anyone knowledgeable about the federal budget, the way all this works, or anybody capable of reading a Congressional Budget Office report could have told you that last year's $1.3 trillion deficit was really mostly an illusion. It was not an indication in any way that the federal deficit was actually shrinking. The White House has lots of people like that. They have lots of people working for them that are capable of reading a Congressional Budget Office report. But the Biden administration chose, for political reasons, to push a different narrative, a clearly false one, and they ignored important context and relied on misleading statistics to do it. So now, a year later, Biden's not talking about the deficit anymore, and the reason is because the deficit's getting a lot bigger. The CBO reported last week that the federal budget deficit is now $1.4 trillion for the first 9 months of fiscal year 2023. That's $900 billion more than it was during the same period last year. And the CBO says that the country is on course to ring up a $1.5 trillion deficit when the current fiscal year wraps up on September 30th. Again, funny that Biden doesn't talk about this. It's less funny that he's also ignoring the long-term trajectory of the federal budget deficit in future years, because rather than shrinking, the gap between federal tax revenue and federal spending is on course to widen dramatically in the coming years. That means the federal government will have to take on more debt, and the rising cost of debt will slow economic growth, drive up interest payments to foreign holders of American debt, elevate the risk of a fiscal crisis, and make the nation's fiscal position more vulnerable to an increase in interest rates. That's what the CBO warned last month when it said the debt was on an unsustainable course. Now, tellingly, Biden has actually opposed the only two small steps that Washington has taken this year towards shrinking the budget deficit. First, there was the debt ceiling deal, which included some discretionary spending caps that will marginally reduce future budget deficits. Biden successfully blocked a House Republican attempt to make those budget caps stricter, and he took off the table any discussion of entitlement spending, which is actually the real driver of these future budget deficits. Then came the Supreme Court's decision to strike down Biden's expensive student loan forgiveness plan, and that might be the biggest deficit reduction thing that happened in Washington this year. That ruling by itself will reduce the 2023 deficit by about $400 billion because it removed Biden's ability to just hand out all that money to college graduates. All of this ought to prove that all that talk we heard last year about deficit reduction from the White House, from President Biden himself and from others, all of that was just political opportunism. Biden was eager to take credit for a falling federal deficit that had nothing to do with his policies, but he now has no apparent interest in the difficult trade-offs that will be necessary to actually curb the federal government's addiction to debt. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of this very important topic and everything else going on in Washington this week at Reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Thank you, Eric. And now I will have this week's American Radio Journal commentary. It is axiomatic that when the left cannot win by the rules, it finds a way to change the rules. That is evident by the wide range of changes to election laws made during the 2020 presidential election cycle. But while producing more Democratic victories, those changes have destroyed voter confidence in our electoral system. A recent Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll found only 22% of Republicans have high confidence that votes in the upcoming U.S. presidential election will be counted accurately. Just prior to the 2022 U.S. Senate election in Pennsylvania, a seat which determined control of the upper chamber, a poll by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research found an astounding 75% of business owners and CEOs were very or somewhat concerned that the election would be fair and accurate. The Supreme Court of the United States, remade with the appointment of three Trump administration justices, has for the most part abandoned the judicial activism of the past in favor of doing what the court is supposed to do, interpret and apply the Constitution to the cases brought before it. In its recently concluded session, the High Court struck down so-called affirmative action, which discriminated based on race, upheld the free speech rights of a web designer who objected to being forced to create sites which violated her personal beliefs, and in a rare unanimous ruling, it upheld the religious rights of a former postal worker who was forced out of his job for refusing to work on Sundays. It should be noted the court also issued rulings relative to congressional redistricting and the power of state courts in the redistricting process, which negatively impacted Republican efforts in those areas. In each case, the court majority based its rulings on constitutional principles. As a result of all this, the left unleashed a torrent of attacks on the Supreme Court and renewed calls for expanding the number of justices, thus enabling President Joe Biden to pack the bench. With Republicans in control of the U.S. House of Representatives, such calls are unlikely to result in an actual change. But once again, when the left doesn't get what it wants, the go-to tactic, change the rules. In the wake of those recent decisions, a post appeared in my Facebook feed. The individual making the post decried the Supreme Court's rulings and plaintively asked, quote, "Why are we letting a dusty old document written by a bunch of old white men preventing us from getting things done?" End quote. This thought process presages the left's deployment of its ultimate rule-changing gambit: destroy the primacy of the U.S. Constitution. Keeping in mind the goal of the left is to fundamentally transform the United States into a big government socialist nation, and it was only a matter of time before the Constitution, the goal of which was or is to limit government and protect individual rights, would come under assault. Setting aside the fact the Founding Fathers were not old white men, but rather youthful individuals in their 20s and early 30s, this animus toward the Constitution is proof positive that the brilliant document which underpins our entire system of government is working as intended. The Constitutional Convention was convened because the Articles of Confederation, the first attempt at binding together the 13 independent colonies, lacked both the structure and power to constitute an effective federal government. A great debate ensued as to how one United States could go about getting things done, while at the same time preventing the creation of an all-powerful government, the likes of which the colonies had just escaped. Seeking to form a more perfect union, the Constitution was submitted to the now 13 former colonies for ratification. That only happened when the document was strengthened with the addition of the first 10 amendments known as the Bill of Rights. Those are the rights the Supreme Court is tasked with protecting and the rights that prevent the left from imposing socialism on the nation. It is that document that prevents the left from taking away our right to keep and bear arms. It is that document that allows a postal worker to be off work for Sunday worship. It is that document that protects a web designer from producing a product with which she disagrees. It is that document that protects prospective students from being rejected by universities based on racial quotas. Supreme Court justices, as does the President and every member of Congress, take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. It is not a dusty old document. Rather, it is the enduring guardian of our rights and freedom. Fortunately, we have a Supreme Court which is doing just that. With an American Radio Journal commentary, I'm Loman Henry. American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KSAK-FM in Walnut, California, KRBL-FM in Lubbock, Texas, along with KCEA-FM in Redwood City, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.